heretofore, in various other contexts, reports of this nature have been restricted, have been subject to classification, and the public has not had the benefit of the knowledge which those who conducted the investigation were presented. In our case, as you know, we had certain roadblocks. We had to push hard for information. We believe that we have done a credible job in unearthing the information which was within our government, and we have gone further. We have attempted to get information which was the result of ongoing interrogations of others who had information, and we have made judgments about the integrity of that information and have reported that. And so we have done our level best to bring forward to the public, and we have done so as we have moved along, all relevant information within our ability to put forward. And I think the American public can feel that this was a credible effort led by extraordinary people and an extraordinary staff, very talented, very dedicated, and extraordinarily hardworking.
Hi, Jeff Rawson from WABC in New York. And speaking about New York specifically for a moment, you heard a good deal in the hearings about radio failures and technical problems. And while you make reference to it in the report, you mentioned that your recommendation is to create a signal core. What exactly does that mean, and how would that solve the radio problems that we experienced in New York?
John Lehman.
We uncovered a fairly significant range of command, control, and communications problems.
Mr. Lehman is former Secretary of the Navy in the Reagan administration, an investment banker, and a novelist.
The military has struggled with this for a long time. Now, today, the normal order of military operations involves all services integrated, working together. Radios that are designed to work at sea don't necessarily work in intense land environments, in cities, in buildings. Military learned long ago that you need a systems approach to radios and to connectivity. In cities like New York especially, that is one of the chief, remains one of the most important, valuable targets of our enemy, we have to be able to assure the connectivity between the commanders, the civilian commanders on scene, the mayor and the civilian authorities, the fire department, fire departments of adjacent areas, of police departments, and in totally different environments, tunnels, skyscrapers, in the port areas and so forth. There's no one radio you can buy to fix that. And so you need a systems approach like the military uses. Every military unit that deploys to an operational area has a signal core type unit with it that has the robust communications of different kinds that can keep the different units connected together and communicating, whether it's in a ship to shore or an air to ground or a ground to ground environment, and with the people trained on how to assure a fail-safe connectivity. That does not exist in New York or most other cities today. And with the assistance of the Pentagon and the federal government, it is a very high priority that this kind of connectivity be established to deal with threats in the future.
Thank you, John. Now, I might say, as far as New York City goes, I personally feel one of the most important
Governor
recommendations
Kane again.
Is that monies from Homeland Security should not be given out as a revenue-sharing program, but should be given largest amounts by far to the areas of greatest need and the most prominent targets. And that would, I presume, give most of that money to New York City, with Washington equal or a close second.
Thanks. Steve Hayes with the Weekly Standard. On this question of the Iraq-Al-Qaeda relationship, it looks as if in this final report you've sort of scaled back some of the language from the staff statement with respect to that finding of no collaborative relationship. This time you say no collaborative operational relationship with regard to the attacks on the United States. Wondered if you might just address that, and then on the same lines, whether you're talking about Richard Clark's emails contained in this final report or Secretary Cohen's testimony to the commission, it appears that the Clinton administration believed in 1998 and believes today that Iraq provided at least some chemical weapons expertise to al-Qaeda, and wondered if you had a comment on that. Thanks.
Well, there was no question in our minds that there was a relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda. There was one point there was thought maybe even al-Qaeda would find sanctuary in Iraq, and there were conversations that went on over a number of years, sometimes successful, sometimes unsuccessfully. While we don't know about weapons collaboration, particularly chemical collaboration, there was a suspicion in the Clinton administration that when they fired that bomb at that factory, that if, in fact, there were chemicals there, they may have come from Iraq. So there was a relationship. Having said that, we found no relationship whatever between Iraq and the attack on 9/11. That just doesn't exist. So I think we were very careful in our wording in using that word collaborative relationship. I mean, that's what we found. It's language. It's evidence-based.
I think there's a very – in further response, I think there's a very large distinction between evidence of conversations that might have occurred between Iraq and al-Qaeda, on the one hand, and an emerging strategy or emerging assistance, concrete, on the other.
Congressman Hamilton.
And what we do not have, as the chairman said, is any evidence of a concrete, collaborative, operational agreement. Conversations, yes, but nothing concrete.
Vince Morris, I'm with the New York Post. I have a question about Saudi Arabia. In reading the report, I noticed that the language that you use to describe that Saudi Arabia is very vague, and it seemed actually a little watered down, given what that country's track record is. I wonder if you can explain that. And I also wonder if you can get into why you did not address any of the issues that have been raised recently by filmmaker Michael Moore about connections between the Saudi family and the bin Laden family and the Bush administration, and whether that may have played any role in all of this.
Well, I haven't seen Mr. Moore's film. I'm not sure what those allegations are. We do talk quite definitively about the allegation that there was a flight of Saudis that took off before airspace was open, authorized by high level in the United States government without the proper interviewing by the FBI. And what we say, that story is just not true. That plane took off. It took off after the airspace was open, after the FBI had screened the people, and it was authorized by Mr. Clark. We do handle that one. We didn't water down any language that I'm aware of in Saudi Arabia. What we do say is that we've got to get beyond this relationship having to do with just oil. We have got to work with the Saudi government that shares a very common interest with us now, because the terrorists would be very, very just as happy, I think, to destroy the government in Saudi Arabia right now as they would our own government. And they have a very common interest in working with us against the terrorists at this point, who have attacked them as well as attacked us. We do believe, however, that our relationship with that country cannot be just, we'll ignore this and that, and they'll give us oil and everything will be fine. We have got to help them and urge them to implement reforms to gain some stability in that country, to help us trace money, if money is a problem, as it gets to terrorist organizations.
Tom, if I may add to that, we have found no evidence of the involvement of the Saudi government in the plot. We have found evidence of individual Saudis and Saudi charities, whether witting or unwitting, we do not know, whose funds have found their way to the support of Al-Qaeda and terrorism. Since 9/11, and especially since May of 2003, Saudi cooperation with regard to the United States has sharply improved, and they are helping us now on the terrorist financing issue. They've taken steps to tighten up the regulation in their financial communities to guard against terrorist financing. As the chairman mentioned, this is a very difficult relationship for the United States and has been for a long time. But we want to see that relationship get more depth and texture to it than it has had in the past several decades. And that relationship should include a shared commitment to political and economic reform in the kingdom, and a shared commitment to greater respect for tolerance in the society, and a shared commitment to fight terrorism, and a shared commitment in the reform area to improve the quality of education. This is a very large agenda that we need to develop with the Saudis because it's such a very important country in this war on terrorism.
Senator Gordon.
I think, you know, in a sense, it's difficult to answer a
Senator
negative.
Slate Gordon, former senator from Washington State.
In the report, we include all of the facts that we regard relevant to Al-Qaeda and the United States and Saudi Arabia and Iraq to the charge which we were given. We do not spend a lot of time, attempting to prove negatives. We lay out the evidence. We lay out the facts. By and large, the conclusions from those facts are left to the American people to make, except when they seem to us to be obvious. So the materials in here on Saudi Arabia are the materials we consider relevant to our report. The materials in here on Iraq are the materials we consider relevant to the report.
Governor Thompson indicated that policymakers will ignore your recommendations sort of at their own peril, but some of these recommendations have been out for a long time. For example, the Joint Inquiry 2 years ago recommended a Director of National Intelligence. Your charter expires in a month. The legislative calendar is very short. You're in an election year. What concrete steps can you take to ensure that your report isn't just on a bookshelf somewhere like so many other blue ribbon commissions?
We've been working on that one ever since the day we were created. We read those other reports. There are a number of commissions who made first-class recommendations. If they'd been implemented, this country would have been better and safer. They were not implemented. They were ignored. The Hart-Rudman Commission comes to mind. The Lockerbie Commission is another one. All commissions which made good recommendations. We have determined as a commission not to let that happen. Now, these are tough recommendations. These are not easy to implement. One of the reasons some of the ones haven't been implemented yet that are made already is because they're tough. They're not easy to do. A lot of these recommendations require changing around the United States government in ways that take power away from some people and reorganize in other ways. That's tough in this town. Very hard to change government agencies. But we think it's essential, and we think it's necessary, and we've made an absolute determination to make the tough recommendations if they were right. And the other thing we decided to do, all 10 of us together, is our charter expires and we go out of business as a commission. We do not go out of business as people. And all 10 of us have decided to keep in touch, to work, implement these recommendations, do everything we can, whether it's testimony or lobbying or speaking or whatever's necessary, to let the American people know about these recommendations, know how important they are, our belief that they can save lives, and continue to work as a group long after our charter goes out of existence. And we've agreed to meet in a year to determine our progress.
Tom, may I add a word to that? I've certainly served on more commissions than any sane man should. In my experience, commissions have clout and impact relating to two factors. One is the quality of work done in the report. At the end of the day, this town does examine ideas. And if the professional work that is done in this report is of the highest quality, as we think it is, that will have an impact on decision makers. The second thing that brings about impact by a commission is the stature of its membership. And I do not think you could exceed the stature of the membership of this commission. We're all, or most of us at least, are former politicians. Some of us, as one of my friends said a moment ago in the Congress, we're washed-up politicians. That's an accurate description, I guess. But we have a pretty good sense and feel of the politics of this town. If you want to look back on commissions, take a look at the Social Security Commission of a few years back and ask yourself whether or not that commission had impact. Believe you me, it had impact. It restructured the entire Social Security system. And even those commissions that are said to simply file their reports on the wall, we built on the commission reports of a dozen commissions. We stand on their shoulders. We are indebted to them. And I think that we cannot judge, we cannot claim at this time that this commission is going to have a big impact. That remains to be seen. But Tom and I have been enormously pleased by the reception we have had in the Republican and Democratic caucuses in the House and in the Senate, by the extraordinary reception we had this morning by the President and the Vice President of the United States. And so we entered the fray here optimistic that we can get some important things done.
If I could disagree slightly with that, I would call myself hopeful but not optimistic.
Former Senator Kerry of Nebraska.
These changes will be enacted prior to another terrorist attack on the United States. Regrettable, though that may be. These are significant changes we're recommending. John Diamond asked earlier, described it as restructuring. This is not a private sector company we're talking about restructuring here. These are changes in law that we're asking for. Changes in law that will give those who apparently have responsibility the authority necessary to carry out their job. And it will require members of Congress, in some cases, to give up committee assignments that they currently have that they love. It will require in the government people to give up authority that they currently have over hiring, over budgets. The Department of Defense, most notably, will be asked to give up substantial authorities, though they will get substantial new authorities. And in my experience in politics, when somebody is asked to give up something, they will come up with all kinds of reasons other than the most important one, which is they don't want to surrender authority, to cite for why they won't want to do it. And I'm hopeful that the circumstances surrounding this commission will cause Congress to act differently, but I am not optimistic. And I will say as well that under the leadership of Governor Kaine and Congressman Hamilton, this commission did something extraordinary. I want to emphasize that. We were selected by elected politicians in the most partisan city in the world, and we reached a unanimous conclusion. And that didn't happen accidentally. This is not the virgin birth you're looking at here. This is 10 people who made a decision that the most important thing for us to do is acquire the unity of purpose that this nation had after we were attacked on the 11th of September. And we need it again before we're attacked again. And I hope, as I said, I'm hopeful that we will acquire it, but I'm not, based upon my experience, optimistic that we will.
We thought about this issue from the very beginning.
And this is Jamie Gorelick, former Deputy Attorney General in the Clinton administration.
One, we decided to be transparent, which is different from the way prior commissions have operated. And you can see that in our report. One little factoid is that our footnotes, if set in a normal typeface that a normal person could read, would be a 250-page book on their own. Our commission, and I have served on other commissions, most notably the Scowcroft Review that dealt with some of these same issues. Most commissions look at policy issues. We started with the facts. And our policy recommendations are tied to those facts and flow ineluctably from them. And so you will find in this report the basis for every single recommendation. And as Jim Thompson says, policymakers ignore that at their peril. So we have the facts. We have 9/11 as a tectonic moment in our history. Slay Gordon and I visited with an editorial board yesterday, and one of the questions we got was essentially this one. Why will you be any different? A Pew poll has come out that shows that over 60% of the American people, even before the rollout of our report, have been following our work and think it's important. We think that this issue has resonance in the country. And the proof will be in whether our leaders come together with the same unity of purpose that we have had to create a unity of effort around the counterterrorism mission. There are bad consequences to being in the middle of a political season, and there are also good ones. Because everyone who is running for office can be asked, do you support these recommendations?
Listening to NPR's live special coverage of the presentation of the 9/11 Commission report in Washington, D.C.
I just want to say that I believe the recommendations in this particular report will be different.
Former Congressman Romer
of Indiana again. Not so much because of the stature of this commission, nor because of the Pew Trust polling data, but because of the perfect storm that is coming together politically. The eyes of history are on our backs, the claws of Al-Qaeda are on our shoulders, and the grief of 9/11 is still in so many Americans' hearts. I think those indicators and reasons are all going to come together and compel members of Congress and others to pass what's in this report and to act on this. We don't have time to waste with another attack coming. We will do a report card in 6 to 12 months to assess what Congress or the White House has done or not done. We will work with the 9/11 families that have been instrumental and their energy and their commitment to create this commission and keeping going on the right track. And furthermore, with the American people as agents of change, I think they will compel the elected officials and policymakers in this country to make the significant changes to make this a country that is safer and more secure in a bipartisan manner. We must take those actions today.
Commissioner Fielding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to add another thing. You know, often in Washington, when a problem occurs and people don't know what to do or it's
Fred
a meddlesome
Fielding,
problem,
Washington
they
lawyer.
Appoint a commission. But what we have here today and the action-forcing event of this commission was something quite unprecedented. And we assumed that responsibility and that was a charter for us to think surgically, but think big. And we had a lot of discussions about this. And many people have said, since it started to leak out as to what our recommendations were, they've said, you know, why do you make recommendations that are so bold? Why do you make recommendations that are going to be very difficult because somebody has to give up something, somebody has to break a cookie jar? Why do you do that? Why don't you do something that you know has a better percentage chance of passing? And I think after our discussions, the answer that we came to, and the reason you see the recommendations we have, is the question is, if not now,
When? So, thank you.
I might say, by the way, that the conversations that Congressman Hamilton and I have had with the leaders in both houses, House and Senate, in both parties, with the President of the United States, with Senator Kerry and Senator Edwards, all those conversations are encouraging. And they give us hope that some of these bold recommendations are, in fact, going to be taken very seriously.
Let's move to questions.
We'll try it again. Mike Kelly, Bergen Record. I was struck in the report by the statement about the failure of imagination in our country. And I would just like to know, you've interviewed many government officials throughout your research. Is that failure subsided? Are we beyond that failure of imagination now? And what is the current state of that?
Do you want to take that one?
I think the failure of imagination we consider to be one of the major failures of the government.
Congressman Hamilton.
The fact of the matter is we just didn't get it in this country. We could not comprehend that people wanted to kill us. They wanted to hijack airplanes and fly them into big buildings and important buildings. Policymakers did not have the imagination to think of that kind of a scenario. There were hints here and there in a variety of places, but as a whole, the government didn't grasp the potential scenario that occurred. We were often advised during the course of the hearings to read very imaginative writers like Tom Clancy, and encouraged to think outside the box. And I think that's an important part of the counterterrorism effort. Have we gotten beyond the lack of imagination? I'm not sure I can answer that today. But I think all of us are aware of the fact that we have to understand we're contending here against a very entrepreneurial, very innovative enemy who know how to penetrate our open society. They understood that they could get a 4-inch knife on board, but maybe not a 6-inch knife. And they understood a lot of other weaknesses in the system. So we have to have an imagination strong enough to think about a number of different scenarios, and it is a very key part of a counterterrorism strategy.
Let me add to this. Part of the problem here is that it's very difficult to imagine something if the facts are withheld
from
you.
Former Senator Kerry is now a college president.
And let me lead with one and use our vice chairman's novelist as the example. In order to have a debate in this country about how much should we spend on intelligence, here's how it has to go. According to Tom Clancy, we will spend $40 billion this year on intelligence. If Mr. Clancy is correct, I believe that's an insufficient amount. Or I'll have to say, according to Tom Clancy, we spend $6 billion on the National Reconnaissance Office, and we spend less on the DCI than we do on the Environmental Protection Agency. And if Mr. Clancy is correct, I believe we spend too little. We can't have a public debate because the American people aren't entitled by law to know how much money we're spending on all these agencies. By law. And in the old world, it was because the Soviet Union knew. We didn't want them to know. Well, we tell everybody how big our Navy is. We tell everybody how big our Army is. We tell them about everything else having to do with national security. But for some reason, how much we spend on intelligence is withheld. And it creates a tremendous problem. Note, for the record, that 75% of what we knew about, found out about Osama bin Laden after 9/11, we knew in 1996. 90% of the facts that we knew about Osama bin Laden, we knew in 1998. But the full story wasn't delivered until after 9/11. It was held in classified, compartmentalized sections. And it produced a tremendous problem. How in God's name are you supposed to imagine a threat if the facts are being withheld from you? I believe central to the problem that we have dealing with a non-nation state actor is the more information you withhold, the less likely it is that Congress and the American people not only are going to imagine the threat, but provide the political support necessary to deal with that threat.
Tim Berger with Time Magazine. First, a quick housekeeping one and then a deeper one. Can you say anything about, was any material withheld because of classification disagreements or, you know, that you simply were not allowed to release? And more deeply, Mr. Hamilton said earlier that one of the problems before 9/11 is there was no answer to the question of who's in charge. You've put forward some recommendations that you hope would fix that, but it could take a while to put them in place. The Homeland Security Department, 15 months later, is still gaining its footing. So it could be a while till there's a statutory answer to that question. In the meantime, is it clear who's in charge now? Is there adequate power and accountability to prevent another terrorist attack?
Well, I'll start with the first question, and Jamie, if you want to take the second, or do you want to take the first?
No, second.
This is a report basically without redactions. When I told that to the members of the United States Congress, their mouths dropped open. We were able to work with this government to enable us to reveal a number of things, including things that had already been redacted from other reports. No, we did not have anything withheld from us. So this is a complete report. The only redactions, I believe, are some of the sources in the PDBs. The PDBs themselves, both the Clinton one and the Bush one, are there in full, but some of the sources may be blacked out. But other than that, there are no redactions and nothing withheld, and we're very, very grateful for that. The second part of the question, Jamie?
Yeah, just to finish up on that first answer, I mean, the staff worked with the administration where necessary to essentially
Jamie Gorelick,
write around
Deputy Attorney
issues.
General in
so
the Clinton
some,
administration.
Statements are perhaps a little less precise than we otherwise would have been, but the no material information has been withheld. On your second question, which I think is a very, very important one, the reason that you're hearing such a tone of urgency in our collective voices is because the answer to the question that I repeatedly asked and numbers of us asked in our hearings, who is in charge, who is our quarterback, was almost uniformly the President of the United States, which of course he is, but this is not his full-time job. And it is an impossible situation for that to remain the case. We offer what we think is a good and helpful solution to that. As Jim Thompson said, it may not be the only solution, but I think the burden is on others to come up with a better one. Right now, the authorities to act cohesively do not exist.
Senator Gordon asked to be excused. He said, there's not any questions you asked. It is instead the fact that he has an appointment with a number of senators who he's going to talk to about our recommendations. I said that was most important, Senator. Godspeed.
Chris Mondix of the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'd like to go back to a question that was raised earlier. Former Defense Secretary William Cohen testified before your commission that to the effect that the Clinton administration believed that Osama bin Laden and Iraq collaborated on the construction of a nerve gas factory in the Sudan. And it was on that basis that the factory was bombed on August 20th, 1998. What I'd like to know is, given your finding that there was no collaborative operational relationship, what was it about that testimony and that issue that caused you not to give weight to Secretary Cohen's testimony before you?
We gave weight to the testimony, and it's the same belief that President Clinton had, the same belief that Sandy Berger has. But there are a whole bunch of people on the other side who dispute that finding, who say there is no independent collaborative evidence that those chemicals were there. And this is a debate that goes on. We were not able to come to a conclusion in that debate, we could say there is no evidence that we've found, independent evidence, that those chemicals were there. But I can tell you that the belief of people we all respect, from the President of the United States, President Clinton, down through Sandy Berger and down through Cohen, believe very, very strongly that they were right to target that factory, and in fact it was what they thought it was. But the evidence is not there, and the facts are being argued against, and we could not come to a fact-based conclusion on that one.
Doug Pasternak at NBC News. You've stayed away from placing blame on both the Clinton and Bush administrations, but could you tell us where you think they could have done a better job, especially in the area of domestic surveillance and collection of intelligence?
Look, we have some of the same comments to make, frankly, about both presidents. We believe they understood thoroughly the threat from Osama bin Laden. We believe they both took actions that they thought were necessary to meet that threat. They met, they talked about it, they talked to their advisors about it. We also believe that they did not take it as seriously as it should be taken. It was not their top priority. It was not up on top of the priority list. And that reflected, by the way, the American people. It reflected the presidential campaign. I mean, we had an entire presidential campaign in 2000, right? Thousands and thousands of words spoken, as are always spoken in presidential campaigns. We can find only one reference to terrorism in the entire campaign. That means the reporters weren't asking questions, the American people weren't asking questions, the Congress wasn't stimulating discussion, and it wasn't there. So, yeah, we do believe both presidents could have done more in this area. But we also believe that, like the rest of us, they did not envision this as the kind of problem it obviously already was. And, by the way, they were not served, in my opinion, they were not served properly by the intelligence agencies of this country. Having read every single presidential daily briefing having anything to do with this subject under two administrations, I can tell you that the two presidents of the United States were not well served by those agencies, and they did not, in my opinion, have the information they needed to make the decisions they had to make.
Tom, if I may just add, I think that both Presidents Clinton and Bush understood that al-Qaeda was a dangerous threat to the country. I think in both cases they took a number of steps, military, covert actions, diplomatic steps, to deal with the threat. Now, obviously it turned out that those steps were not sufficient. What I believe, and I think we say in our report, is that they, like the rest of us, did not understand the gravity of the threat. Or to put it another way, they did not understand that 3,000 people could be killed in an hour's time. If you look back, all of us had signals. We recite those signals at great length in the report, and we simply did not put them together to understand that terrorism was the predominant national security threat to the United States. You didn't have to have access to PDBs or secret information to figure that out. There's a long list of attacks by terrorists against the United States, but we simply did not understand how serious and how grave the threat was. So my view is that the presidents acted, understood that a threat exists, but like most of us, did not understand the gravity of it.
If I could add to it, too, I think one of the things that we say in the report is that, and it's difficult to say it, but the
former
facts,
Senator Kerry.
bear the conclusion out that when attacks were over there, they weren't as powerful a motivator as attacks that are here. When Yusuf and Mir Ahmad Khanzi killed Americans on U.S. soil in 1993, in January and February of 1993, Yusuf blowing up the World Trade Center, Khanzi killing two CIA employees in Langley, we didn't have to demonstrate that they were the overriding threat to the United States of America to deploy all our resources to hunt them down until we were able to render them back to the United States and then try them and convict them, which is what we did. Both of those men were brought to justice in the United States of America, and we didn't find ourselves troubled by all kinds of diplomatic nicety requirements, et cetera, or that we had to prove that there was a great national security threat here. I say again, one of the problems with Osama bin Laden is that I'm uncomfortable actually having to say to the American people, I'm not sure that either President Clinton or President Bush had the full narrative of who he was until after 9/11, that he was involved with a series of attacks against U.S. military and civilian personnel for 9 years prior to 9/11. I'm not 100% certain that all of those things were known by either President Clinton or by President Bush prior to 9/11.
And one of the reasons for this failure of imagination really gets right to the heart of our organizational recommendations, because it was an institutionalized failure of imagination.
John Layman, former Secretary of the Navy.
We went into the 21st century in an era of transnational terror with a government apparatus that was designed following World War II to fight the Cold War. It's a 50-year-old apparatus dating from the 1947 National Security Act, and it is one that totally separates foreign intelligence and foreign threats from domestic. And our domestic security was simply utterly incapable of imagining the threat and dealing with it that was internal to the United States. So that is why we are not just recommending moving around the deck chairs and boxes on organization charts. There is a deep fundamental dysfunction in the way we go about our intelligence gathering and analysis and providing the data to the decision makers.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. You talk in the report about assistance from Hezbollah and Iran to al-Qaeda. We've heard recently about the hijackers who passed through Iran. But you also say that any relationship currently between Iran and Hezbollah seems to have been concealed. Is it your view that there is a current relationship, a collaborative relationship, between Iran and al-Qaeda?
We don't know of any current relationship, I don't think, seen in our research. We do know there were relationships in the past. We do know that these relationships were serious and over a period of time. We do know that when people wanted to get through Iran to Afghanistan to meet with Osama bin Laden, including a number of the hijackers, were able to do so without marks in their passports that would indicate they had been through Iran. We know that kind of collaboration. But there is no evidence whatsoever, for instance, that Iran knew anything about the attack on 9/11, or certainly assisted it in any way whatsoever. So we know of a relationship. How deep that relationship is, and we don't know if it exists to this day. That's going to require more research.
I think this is an area that really does need more investigation. What we find at this point is, number one, Iran and Hezbollah did provide assistance to various types to al-Qaeda in the years before 9/11. And secondly, as the chairman has said, we have not seen evidence that would suggest that Iran or Hezbollah had any pre-knowledge of 9/11. And it is our view that al-Qaeda planned this operation and carried it out by themselves.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you all. We do believe that in this volume are recommendations that will make the American people safer. Thank you all very much.
Chairman Thomas Kane, the former governor of New Jersey, who has been the chairman of the September 11th Commission that has just presented its report, joined, of course, by its co-chair, Congressman Lee Hamilton, former congressman from Indiana, and the other 10 commissioners. Scott Simon, NPR News in Washington, D.C. I'm joined by Mary Louise Kelly, NPR's intelligence correspondent. Let me just revisit and then turn to Mary Louise some of the major pronouncements we heard from the commission today. Governor Kane began by saying that the U.S. government failed to protect the American people on September 11, 2001. At the same time, he said the commission had found no one person responsible, no high-ranking government official, or for that matter, no airport security guard. The commissioners kept emphasizing responsibility was spread, not just in the administration branch or one administration or another, but through Congress. And many commissioners said, and in a democracy, the American people, too, and for that matter, the American media. The commission did list operational opportunities, items as seemingly minute as discovering erroneous information on passport applications or 4-inch blades in airport security machines, but it declined to say that any of these operational opportunities in and of itself would have prevented the attacks on September 11th, although almost all of the operational opportunities they listed did seem to trace back to a failure of government and security agencies to share information at different levels. A phrase that kept coming back into the parlance of the commissioners was that there was a failure of imagination, that people of all levels of government failed to apprehend the dimension of the threat from al-Qaeda or terrorism, although, of course, there had been attacks before. Commissioner Bob Kerry pointed out that those attacks had mostly occurred overseas. The commissioner said, in fact, there will be attempted attacks again. Both the Clinton and Bush administration came in for some criticism and from some absolution from criticism. Chairman Kane said that both administrations understood that Osama bin Laden was a threat, but they did not make destroying him either administration a top priority. Congressman Hamilton was very blunt. He said neither administration was well served by U.S. intelligence agencies, and neither president had the information he needed. He also added that that failure of apprehension was shared by the press and, for that matter, the American people. They emphasized that al-Qaeda was a studied adversary. They went to school, in a sense, on airplane flights and understood exactly how they could sneak 4-inch blades aboard. They spent money. Bob Kerry said, Senator Kerry, that neither president had the information he needed on Osama bin Laden, and he said the changes in the law will be necessary. And several commissioners said from their experience in politics that's going to be a very difficult thing to bring about, perhaps, in an election year, because nobody likes to give up power. We'll just mention this. They did say there was a relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda, but not what they called a collaborative operational relationship that related to the attacks of September 11th. Mary Louise Kelly, let's turn to you. What are some of the points you noticed?
I think several things. First, as you said, in response to the sort of overarching question that has hung over all of these proceedings as this commission has mm-hmm. gone through its investigation, the big question I think a lot of us have waited to hear an answer to was, could September 11th have been prevented? Mm-hmm. And on that question, this commission is basically declining to answer. They have gone through a tremendous amount of interviews and documents and compiled this near 600-page document. And they're essentially saying some people are going to look at the evidence and say yes. Other people will look at this mountain of evidence and say no. Many of us will conclude it's just impossible to say whether all of these missed opportunities, lack of information sharing, things that didn't go right, had things been corrected, could we have stopped September 11th? So we don't have an answer to that. We probably never will. In terms of the sort of major reforms they're recommending, some very interesting things. We knew, have known for a few days now that they would recommend a national intelligence director, a new position who would report directly to the president, would have overarching authority and budgetary control over all 15 U.S. intelligence agencies. That will be controversial. It will be resisted, certainly, at the Pentagon. It's not clear where the White House stands on this, and indeed where members of Congress who would have to legislate this stand. One other thing that will be interesting.
This would mean giving up money, giving up employees, giving up authority in certain questions for various government agencies?
Yes, certainly for the CIA and the Pentagon would be the sort of major
losers, if you want to look at it from that point of view, if you were to create another sort of level, reporting straight to the president as the president's main advisor. The idea here is that if there was not adequate information sharing, we need to have somebody who can bash heads together and make all of these different agencies respond. In that same vein, the commission is also recommending another controversial thing, the creation of a national counterterrorist center. There is right now a counterterrorist center, but it's within the CIA, and the idea here is we need to have more buy-in from the other agencies, from the FBI, from Defense Department intelligence agencies, and that would be another new position, new center in the White House, but a very different way of doing things. And again, that will be, I'm sure, fought tooth and nail by people at the CIA and the Pentagon in terms of that would take a lot of authority away from them.
And you've been listening to live coverage from National Public Radio of this morning's 9/11 Commission unveiling finally their report on the terrorist attacks of September 11th. If you're interested in reading that report, by the way, and you have internet access, you may go to their website, which is www.911commission.gov. And I think that a print report will be available in bookstores if you'd like to read it that way. I'm certain that we'll continue to talk about this now in the weeks and the months ahead. One program specifically, though, that we have scheduled for next week here on Focus 580, I'd like you to know about. Next Thursday in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with Stephen Strasser. He's a former foreign correspondent and editor at Newsweek magazine, and he is the editor of a newly published book which is titled The 9/11 Investigations, which brings together the staff investigative report that the commission made available. That's also on their website, but you can see it in book form. And he spent a lot of time going over the conclusions of the commission, and I'm sure he'll have some things to say about that and, of course, can take your questions. That will be 1 week from today, next Thursday, July 29th, in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus 580. The program today here on AM 580, made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. Tomorrow morning on the show, Jack Brighton will be sitting in the first hour, taking questions on the care of companion animals. Two guests on the show, one guest at least, Dr. Stephen Marks. He is professor and chief of small animal medicine at the U of I College of Vet Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. That's tomorrow at 10. Hope you'll stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we go to the archives for an interview with writer Rachel Cohen. She is the author of A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. September wheat trading at 324 unchanged, December unchanged at 337 and a half. September corn 221 down 5 1/4, December 230 down 4 1/2, March 238 and a quarter down 4 1/2.